they're full of answers. The problem is, as Critchley points out in both of the articles, really, but particularly actually in Certainty, Lessons from Auschwitz, is that what really happens is grand narratives create blind spots. They create deep, deep blind spots. And there's also, this isn't talked about in the articles, but this is something that I've always thought is kind of interesting, and you can, correct me if you think I'm spewing BS, but I also think another component of like grand ideologies and grand systems is there's also like a personal investment there from those involved. Like once you get into it, once you get involved, you're kind of like making a commitment. It's sort of like as people go out and they search for their lovers, they're looking for the one. Once you think you've found the one, like you really want it to be true. You want it to be real. And that often gives, particularly when we're talking about political ideologies and stuff like that, but you can even see it in like people who are like super committed to like one, or people who are like, I'm a utilitarian, right? Like there's like an intensity to that kind of commitment because it is a commitment. It does become a way of life. And because there's so much room for mistake there, there's so much room for error because, unlike they're like a published work, like we were talking about earlier, like they're set in stone versus like, someone like Kofi who's out there talking all day, just kind of doing his thing, lecturing every day. If he says something the first day he doesn't agree with, he can turn around and say, actually, next lecture, I said something yesterday that's totally BS. It doesn't make any sense. Like Nick said, I don't believe it anymore.
Yeah, and you might turn that into like a useful exercise or like a moment of humility or something like that. But a book can't do that.
Exactly, a book can't do that, but you also have that flexibility, right? And it's the inflexibility, it's the commitment and the inflexibility that I actually think leads to situations like Auschwitz or the myriad of other, horrific situations or whatever it's been. Horrific and, well, frankly, not so horrific, but all that kind of stuff comes from people being deeply not just dogmatic, but also deeply committed to their own dogma.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. I would say that there's something sort of constitutive about their involvement for that particular person. So if I think about something like you can think of any ideology, any time that anyone is involved in something like that, it's very easy to see that person as kind of wedded to it. I wonder if that's an interesting phenomenological overlap, that the sense that it gives you all the answers, since it relieves this. So like when we have a question, when we have a real question, there's this kind of intellectual tension that we experience, right? And when you get that answer, it's like a jigsaw piece just like falling into place, and it's like perfect, it's satisfying, the tension has been released. I wonder if the feeling of not belonging or looking for one's place, that release of tension from the answers can kind of, it can be, you can misrecognize that as, this is my calling, or this is where I belong. You have that release of tension, and now you experience, questioning going away, but you experience it as, like fitting into some world picture or history making sense, or your background kind of coming back into place or something like that. Because I think it's a good observation that people become invested in these things personally. It's constitutive of someone's identity or ego in some certain way. Like you don't just become a part of an ideology and not, put on the ism on your shirt or ist, I guess, as it were.
So I think that's the arrogance of many philosophers, and as Critchley is pointing out, like, really, like if you were to take a step back and be like, does anybody actually know everything? You'd be like, no, right? Like, obviously not. Human ideologies are obviously human creations, often like communal, and often over great lengths of time, and often they are very complex and have many accuracies, but they can't capture everything, right? Like, and that's kind of, I think, the point. And it's sort of, as Critchley says, and before I say what Critchley's going to say, I just want to point out that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and it's Hale and Brandon, and we're talking today about certainty in philosophy and ideology, mainly based off of two New York Times articles by philosopher Simon Critchley. One thing that Critchley points out, this is a philosophy show, right? And one thing that Kenny kind of points out in both articles a little bit, but especially in There Is No Theory of Everything, is, okay, well, then what is philosophy for, right? Like, if it's not, if creating grand narratives isn't what it's about, like creating grand systems isn't what it's about, or it doesn't actually work very well to everybody's frustration, then what is philosophy actually like doing? Like, why are you listening to this episode right now?
It's difficult if we're not here to get our book written and published, or to solve some problem, or to make some kind of progress. I mean, I think that's one illusion that I'm still kind of stuck in, even though I know it's not true. It's this idea that philosophy is modeled on the sciences and it's making progress just like the sciences or something like that, even though I know that's false and I even have like some theoretical underpinnings for why that is. It's really difficult to kind of sit with the possibility that philosophy might just be this, it might just be this thing we do. It might have some kind of byproduct, but it's not necessarily, that's not necessarily the point. You know, we might come up with metaphysical systems or something like that. In kind of following Kiyofi's example of clarifying problems or coming to insights, if it's just about clarifying things, there's this feeling of, okay, well, clarifying for what? Because we want to feel like the thoughts that we have are for some purpose. But that might not really be the case. I mean, Hannah Arendt entertains the possibility that the experience of thinking is just the experience of your mind being alive. And since there's no answer to the question, why am I alive? There is no answer to the question, why do I think?
You've hit it, one of the great philosophical questions of all time. Why are we here? Why am I alive? Obviously, you can get into the Camus side of things. Well, why don't I just take my own life then? Blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. I think that, but Critchley has a lovely moment, one of his articles, where he basically points out that probably the case is that if you knew the reason, like if you actually were like, someone was like, okay, here's the scientific reason, piece of paper, this is why everything is, it would be pretty underwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Like it would not, like you would just have like, you'd just have a fact like sitting in front of you.
Yeah.
Like if I came on this show and said, like, you know, everybody got the answers to everything. So the universe is actually this, you know, this big expanding, contracting thing of energy. It's been around forever. It just does it over and over again. This is just one of those times where everything blew up in a certain pattern, and this is what happened. So do you know what you're going to have for lunch tomorrow? Why would anyone actually care?
What would be the use of it? Why does it matter? If that question arises, well, it hasn't solved everything, has it? It's really difficult to realistically conceive, and the answer, it's not going to solve that either, especially if you just like have it on a piece of paper. Again, I think that goes back to this idea that maybe thinking is kind of just a symptom of being alive, because a living thing, it persists through time, you know, in its environment and is trying to sustain itself in some way. You can't have an answer in advance of the circumstances of life, at least not like, you can have plans and stuff like that. And what that is a part of what reasoning is. It does go back to this. I think the drive, so if we are thinking about it as, okay, the reason we want answers is because we want to, you know, address things ahead of time. That seems like a realistic sort of, what do I want to say? I don't want to say like a genealogy, but it's a good explanation for why we would want answers. I mean, imagine someone says, okay, well, I just get hungry every time I eat, so why don't I just eat everything right now and I'll never be hungry? That's not how it is. You have to do it, you know, over time. The philosopher says, okay, well, there's all these problems. Why don't we just solve all the problems right now? okay, well, that's not how it is, because you go through life over time.
And I think one thing to point out, that you kind of made an interesting point there, where you're like, okay, well, what if somebody actually knew everything, right? Like, what if that was a thing? And then you're like, well, it's not a thing. Well, why isn't it a thing? And it isn't a thing because it's not the kind of being that we are. I know this gets, we're kind of getting off track with Christian a little bit, but it does make me think back. You and I have talked again so many episodes. We go back, bring up Heidegger in some kind of way. There's a certain, I'm going to bring it up very lightly, there's a certain kind of being that humans have, right? And Heidegger writes about that particularly in terms of temporality, right? In terms of, you know, being thrown from a past, finding oneself situationally in the present, you know, directing one's life towards a future, whatever, right? Different kind of stuff. But that structure also has similarities with knowledge too. Like, if you were somebody who knew everything, you wouldn't like really be a person anymore. Like, part of being a person is being ignorant, right? And as Kofi and Wittgenstein and so many people point out, like, part of philosophizing is constantly dealing with and reinterpreting new problems. And part of the reason we do that is because we don't know everything. We're constantly sort of like marching our way through a jungle of ignorance, coming across new problems, new people, new situations that constantly require different forms of interpretation, which is what part of why, like, as at least Kofi thought, one aspect, or in Kofi's mind, perhaps the main aspect, and that's certainly debatable to me too, but it's this kind of like philosophy's point is like dividing, okay, when are we at a point when we need, you know, scientific descriptions? When are we at a point when we need humanistic interpretations for what we're dealing with, right? Like, but that's that kind of point of like you're constantly doing those things. The problem with grand theories of everything, the problem with grand ideologies is they don't accept ignorance. They don't, like, they really, really, really struggle with that, because there is also too, ironically, kind of, because it's like admitting of themselves that they're all meant out to be, but especially with something like grand ideologies, they're always in competition with each other for explaining the world, right? And if you admit, like, if you come to the stadium, if you come to the SmackDown ring and you're like, hey, I'm this ideology, and I got a bunch of holes that I accept about myself, right? That's a problem. Like, that's probably more honest. Like, that's probably more realistic, but it's highly problematic. Yeah, it's highly problematic for your system, right? And actually, systems then alternate them. Let's get a little, we're having a, sometimes we do this with philosophy show. We just chat. We're going an interesting direction here. Let's talk about how ideologies in practice deal with that. We're pulling out Mark Fisher from like a couple of years ago, Capitalist Realism. It's been a while since I've read the book, so we're not going to give like a great narrow view here. But part of Fisher's point with that is Capitalist Realism, which for our listeners, by the way, is a theory about the ideology of capitalism and how it's basically seeped into all aspects of living and thinking and existing in the modern world. You know, Mark Fisher, who was a British author, his famous line is, you know, you can't imagine a reality without capitalism. Like, you can't actually do it. And I think that that's an example of like a current sort of ethos, a current ideology, a current system basically bleeding itself into everything. And even though it doesn't actually like fit on everything and it doesn't really work, that commodification aspect, that value aspect, still permeates or nearly everything within the system, because that's the only way it can survive. It can remain viable. Grand ideologies don't remain viable in competition with each other. So if you have one, capitalism in this case, that has just it doesn't really have any major competitors, so it's basically like plaster it on everything, like get it everywhere, don't leave blank spaces, because blank spaces end up being antithetical to the system itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's an explanation for the fact that it's essentially impossible to imagine a life without capitalism. I mean, so one of the examples of this that I think of is when people play Dungeons and Dragons, you have to, usually it's set in the past. So they will, you have a one particular player who runs the game and has to construct a medieval world. Interestingly enough, usually when people are constructing medieval economies for these games, they end up being market driven. They end up being capitalistic. They can't imagine what feudalism actually looks like. Even if they research it, they're so stuck in capitalism that they can't imagine an alternative economic system. Even when they do the research, even when they're given templates, they always revert back to capitalist ideology of seeing things in terms of commodification, that this is worth this much by this coin because people are trading it in this way. They can't imagine a situation where things are not valued by monetary value, but, well, by feudalistic standards, in which value isn't really, it doesn't have the same meaning. Capitalist ideology is such that it underpins your very mode of thinking, your sort of apparatus for approaching a problem. And if you had holes in that, then you just wouldn't have a mode of thought, because all of your thoughts are complete in a certain sense. It structures that experience.
Here you have like a primary ideological system, a lot of people would call it neoliberal capitalism, that really permeates like a large portion of the globe. And I think it's very easy to see how, just like Krishley is sort of talking about, how, you know, dogmatic systems are sort of self-growing and self-perpetuating because they need to appear as if they are the only thing if they are going to have all the answers, right? Because if you, like, if, say, you know, capitalism and communism weren't really in competition, you'd be like, oh yeah, this is how the world works. You know, we buy and trade, we have a free market, we sort of let the community decide on the ground level. That's how the world works. But not actually, because there's another whole other world where things work like basically the opposite way around. But like, are like that, you don't need to talk about that, right? Like that's not to say like a comparison of one is better than the other. It's more the point that like these sorts of dogmatic systems have a claim to truth, and you can't have two claims to the same.
At least not about the same thing. Say, for example, you have like a Marxist perspective that sees everything in terms of class struggle, and then you have like a feminist perspective that sees everything in terms of patriarchy and whatnot. Those might actually complement each other in some readings, and you might use one as a lens for seeing some problems and another as a lens for seeing other problems. But something like a capitalist ideology versus like a communist ideology, they're kind of vying for a particular way of seeing commodities and how value is structured and whatnot. They work in competition there because they're trying to fill in gaps that each other fill, or that gaps that actually exist in those systems. So capitalism does have contradictions that communism tries to like solve and whatnot, but at the same time they're trying to tear each other's holes kind of apart in that way.
As part of this discussion, you use the term lens. You have to look through a particular lens. We're being pretty critical of ideology in this episode. We're being kind of like open about the fact that like these systems are never as complete as they claim to be. And yet, you know, another piece of sort of media that you and I looked at for this episode was a video by the philosophy YouTuber Then and Now, specifically about Jordan Peterson and his ideological takes. Long and short of it is Jordan Peterson is self-proclaimed anti-ideological, right? Like, ideologies are bad, you know, because they lead people to do bad things, just like Bronowski is talking about in there, just like Critchley is kind of pointing out with Theories of Everything. They lead us down dark roads. As the Then and Now YouTube channel points out, it also seems like, how could you not be ideological? Like, you don't necessarily have to be dogmatic, but nobody walks around the world with this like truly neutral, you know, kind of like floating external observer type position. You know, everybody who operates in the world takes every time you well, even when you wake up, but like just in throughout your existence, at any point, we're taking enormous numbers of things for granted. And what we take for granted and why has an enormous impact on how we view the world and how we interact with other people. All of that is some kind of ideology, but then says ideologies are bad, and then goes on to talk about, you know, Christian inspirations for living, which is, you know, like pretty ideological, right? It's a lot of ideas that fit into like a certain kind of logic about the world.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's right on the tin. But I mean, that's the thing. That's the frustrating thing about that is it's an ideology that I'm going to reference something we sometimes talk about. It's the mask that isn't a mask, as it were. It's really gotten down to that core explanation. You know, this is the way to see things. If you just set aside. So what I find interesting about this particular structure or this particular move, I should say, is it's not so much someone saying, hey, here's a way of looking at the world. It's you need to clear up all of your ways of looking at the world. You need to take off these masks. You need to stop seeing things in terms of class, in terms of, you know, gender, in terms of nationality or whatever like that. You just need to get to the truth. And here it is, by the way. This kind of ties into something else that I only noticed this after I watched that video that you shared with me. And it's really interesting how if you think about, okay, think about critics of ideology. Usually it's people who take one of these ideological perspectives. So like you could think of a Marxist critique of ideology or like a feminist critique of ideology. It's interesting that supposed ideologues have critiques of ideology. The thing that So I'm putting this on, in contrast with Jordan Peterson's, you know, total eschewment of all ideologies. And it makes me feel like when someone is, say, a Marxist and they have a critique of ideology, it almost feels like they've kind of done their homework. Yes, I've looked into the ideologies. All of them are based on like perspectives. Here's the perspective that I take for looking at other perspectives. I'm not going to pretend like I have the truth. There's other things out there. I have kind of looked into how these lenses work. Here's one that I use or find useful, or I find that has a lot of explanatory power for me. I'm not going to lie to you that I have the truth. This is one way of looking at things. There's other ways if you want to go to a different department. It just seems more honest than you need to stop seeing things in terms of things. It's like, well, how do I avoid doing that? Also, when I do start seeing things, what am I seeing things in terms of, you know?
Even the sort of like negation of seeing things in terms of stuff, a negation of ideology is in itself, like that's the thing, it's just another perspective. At the end of the day, you know, Critchley is quite critical of ideological systems, of grand narratives. Fair enough. Grand narratives are highly problematic, but narratives are not. Like, we all have particular narratives, and we frankly mostly have shared narratives, and those are effectively what ideologies are, right? And a lot of times they're a lot more like loosely knit than just say something like Marxism, which even though it's like written out in giant tomes and all that kind of stuff, at the end of the day is a very thought out, systematized ideology. Most of us, I think, live in a kind of like loose cultural ideology permeated by something like capitalist realism. I think Mark Fisher was actually kind of correct, but has a lot of other stuff going on as well. And it's like, you can't, like, even if you are like saying, oh, I'm going to escape this, you guys are all sheep because you like hang out and walk on this field. So I'm going to hop this fence and I'm going to walk in that field over there. Structurally, it's the same thing. It's the same thing, right? Like, you can't not walk, right? Just like you can't not operate in the world. And again, like, operating in the world requires a whole bunch of background knowledge, background practices, base assumptions that like you have to have them to operate. And even if you change them all around, they're still there. they still allow you to be operational. And frankly, you wouldn't be able to change them all around and operate like in our like current, in your like actual current world. You couldn't like operate with all like the systems and components of someone living through 12th century France. And like, you know, like just like suddenly inject that into someone's head and be like, okay, like now go out, like do your thing. Like it wouldn't make any sense.
No, like, it would be their behavior would probably be unrecognizable, honestly. I think the thing for Critchley, though, is that if ideologies and human descriptions of things are unavoidable, we have to live in terms of vague perspectives. I mean, but the point is that we try and clarify them, and that clarification comes with examining them. So the condemnation or our right sort of warning about ideologies is when they become veils, when they become explanations that can be used in advance of any given situation. I don't need to consult the actual facts to see if my ideology works to explain this. As soon as you do that, you are essentially, you're not actually like looking at the world anymore. And that's what Critchley is warning us about. That is what Dr. Bernowski is warning his viewers about. We need to operate on assumptions. That's just how we live. When we make those assumptions explicit and we force them on the facts, that's when things go really wrong.
I thought that was really succinctly said, and I think it's a great place to end.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
I hope you all enjoyed our show.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, Silent Crimes Broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
Deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer, because too many others know what's happening out there.